All right, good to see you back after the break. And as threatened in the break, we will begin with the drills of the kings of the north and the kings of the south, that is, of Israel and Judah. It behooves you to know these in order, okay? It's a good thing to know in order. And let's begin with, shall we, with Judah and with Rehoboam. You know what the hand motions mean. I'll see if I can do them. I sometimes get completely messed up. But we will try it, beginning with Rehoboam. Rehoboam, Abijah, Asa, Jehoshaphat, Jehoram, Ahaziah, Athaliah, Joash, Amaziah, Azariah, Jotham, Ahaz, Hezekiah, Manasseh, Ammon, Josiah, Jehoahaz, Jehoiakim, Jehoiachin, Zedekiah. If I babble on, then I would be a liar. Oh, so good. And it just dawns on me that I'm going to be the only silly person who's heard on the tape doing this, and you people will all be exonerated. Oh, dear. All right, now we go to the kings of Israel, the kings of the north, beginning with, of course, Jeroboam, and it's 3, 9, 8. 9 in the ninth, 8 in the eighth. So beginning with Jeroboam. Jeroboam, Nadab, Baasha, Elah, Zimri, Tivni, Omri, Ahab, Ahaziah, Jehoram, Jehu, Jehoahaz, Jehoash, Jeroboam, Zechariah, Shalom, Menachem, Pekiah, Pekah, Hoshea. Then came Assyria and took them all away. Okay, good. Very good. Well done. You're actually learning those quite well. Keep doing that and don't forget them, at least not before the final. Okay. All right. Well, we come now to a new section. We're skipping over a few chapters and coming to really the heart of the book, which deals with Elijah, Elisha, and of course Ahab, Jezebel, and other colorful characters in the book of Kings. If you remember from your first outline that we had a while back, this central section in the book, which runs from the end of 1 Kings 16 to 2 Kings 12, really records the contest between Yahweh, between God, and the gods of Canaan. And this takes place during the days mainly of Ahab, of the Omrid dynasty, son of Omri. And we don't have time, of course, in this particular class to cover all the ground as it deserves. I was mentioning again in the break that the body of material that we cover in this course, I think, or on average at least, in all of the Old Testament courses we teach, the body of text we cover is about the size of the New Testament. So many things cannot be handled as fully as we might like, and we have to skip things and run over things. The question also arose as to whether we would indeed ever get to Ezra Nehemiah. We will get to Ezra Nehemiah, even if only in a very short and brief fashion next week. So be prepared for Ezra Nehemiah. I would hate for you to lose the joy of doing those outlines and such. So please have those ready. Now, we want to look at Elijah as an example of the kind of thing that we find, the kinds of episodes that we find in this very important central section. I'm not going to try to cover the whole of the stories of Elijah and Elisha. I just want to choose a sample episode, but as we move toward that, I want to set it up by sort of surveying the career of Elijah. His name, Elijah, means Yahweh is my God. There's some debate about the preciseness of that, but that is essentially the name. Yahweh is my God. This is to be compared with the name Elisha, which seems to mean my God saves. And their names in many ways are reflective of their ministries. Yahweh is my God is the essence of the message which Elijah brought about. Elijah's career intersects largely with the reign of King Ahab of Israel, though Elijah survives him by about 5 years, dying in 2 Kings 2, or perhaps more properly, ascending in 2 Kings 2 during the reign of Jehoram, the son of Ahab and the younger brother of Ahaziah. So we do Omri, Ahab, Ahaziah, Jehoram. Okay, Jehoram was the younger brother of Ahaziah, but a son of Ahab. Now, the career of Elijah, like that of his successor, is characterized by miraculous signs. And it's interesting, I mentioned in the Art of Biblical History that sometimes when people talk about the careers of Elijah and Elisha, they compare them to the parables which Jesus spoke. But a far better comparison is with the miracles that Jesus wrought. He compares his miracle-working ministry to that of Elijah and Elisha. And it's not as if miracles are happening all the time in the Old Testament. It does seem that certain miraculous things do cluster around the ministries of Elijah and Elisha. Already in 1 Kings 17, where Elijah first appears, we read of a divinely ordained drought that Elijah announces beforehand. Then we read of miracles of flour and of oil and the raising even of the widow's son, already in chapter 17. Then in chapter 18, we have the famous event on Mount Carmel, the contest between Elijah, the prophet of the true God, and the prophets of Baal. And again, that's not going to be the episode on which we focus, but I assume you know that story, and we will hark back to it a little bit as we actually focus our attention on chapter 19. Chapter 19 is an enigmatic story of retreat by Elijah, who has just won a great victory on Mount Carmel, and then in chapter 19 turns and flees. Sort of post-exam letdown, I suppose. Or something along those lines. But we want to look at that more closely in just a minute. But we're continuing now the survey of his career. In chapter 20, the focus shifts away from Elijah to the infamous incident of Ahab's coveting of Naboth's vineyard and Jezebel's eventual acquisition of Naboth's vineyard. Elijah's only role in those chapters is to confront Ahab in chapter 21. And also to pronounce judgment on his house. And so Elijah kind of is in the background as we get into chapter 20. And then in 2 Kings 2, we have the account of Elijah's passing, ascending, and of his replacement by his good-looking assistant, Elisha. That is a perennial exam question. Who was better-looking, Elijah or Elisha? And just remember who's asking it, and maybe you'll get it right. Now, we come then to this sample episode from the career of Elijah, and that is the episode in chapter 19. Remember the setting? It's on the heels of his victory in chapter 18, a victory over the prophets of Baal that was dramatic, that was exciting, that seemed complete, but that's just the question. Was it complete? Was it a complete victory? In chapter 18, Elijah seems to think so. Look at verses 41 and following. And Elijah said to Ahab, "Go eat and drink, for there is the sound of a heavy rain." So Ahab went off to eat and drink, but Elijah climbed to the top of Carmel, bent down to the ground and put his face between his knees. And here he says, "Go and look toward the sea," he told his servant, and he went up and looked. "There is nothing there," he said. Seven times Elijah said, "Go back." The seventh time the servant reported, "A cloud as small as a man's hand is rising from the sea." So Elijah said, "Go and tell Ahab, hitch up your chariot and go down before the rain stops you." Remember, this is still the working out of that drought that was begun back in chapter 17. "Go down before the rain stops you." Meanwhile, the sky grew black with clouds. The wind rose. A heavy rain came on, and Ahab rode off to Jezreel. The power of the Lord came upon Elijah, and tucking his cloak into his belt, he ran ahead of Ahab all the way to Jezreel. This guy is on a high. I mean, he has really seen God work, and he's excited, and he's able to outrun a chariot. The victory was dramatic. Was it complete? There are a few things in chapter 18 that give us pause for thought. Look at verse 19 of chapter 18, still as background to the story that we get to in chapter 19. So, 18:19, verse 19 we read, "Now summon the people from all over Israel to meet me on Mount Carmel, and bring the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table. That's the challenge that Elijah had issued in chapter 18. Notice, however, verse 22. Then Elijah said to them, "I am the only one of the Lord's prophets left, but Baal has 450 prophets." Notice also verse 40. Then Elijah commanded them, after his dramatic victory, then Elijah commanded them, "Seize the prophets of Baal. Don't let anyone get away." Now, do you notice anything missing here? What's missing? The prophets of Asherah. There were some no-shows. Okay, the challenge had been issued against the prophets of Baal and the prophets of Asherah that eat at Jezebel's table. And apparently only the Baal prophets showed up. And perhaps because of Jezebel's political astuteness, she kept her prophets back. She adopted a wait-and-see attitude, perhaps. But what are we to make of this missing contingent? Jezebel, it turns out, as Elijah is soon to realize, is the more threatening foe. She's the general. Ahab is not. He's the king, but she's the general. She is the one who is reported to have killed the prophets back in verse 4 of chapter 18. While Jezebel was killing off the Lord's prophets, Obadiah had taken 100 prophets and hidden them in two caves, 50 in each. Or in verse 13 of chapter 18, "Haven't you heard, my Lord, what I did while Jezebel was killing the prophets of the Lord?" Jezebel is the enemy. She's the most threatening foe. Ahab was, if we can use the term, something of a wimp. Look at verses 16 to 18 in chapter 18. So Obadiah went to meet Ahab and told him, and Ahab went to meet Elijah. When Ahab saw Elijah, he said to him, "Is that you, you troubler of Israel?" "I have not made trouble for Israel," Elijah replied, "but you and your father's family have. You have abandoned the Lord's commands and have followed the Baals." And Elijah is able just to face him down and to issue the challenge. And Ahab has no reply. And in fact, will have no more to say. He's compliant. He agrees to the challenge. And his prophets come out. But Jezebel's are held back. Now that's the background to the story we get to then in chapter 19. Now in this reading of this story, I'm going to do this. I want to draw your attention to a long-awaited commentary by Ian Provin, which is finally out. I told you that it might come out in November at SBL, and it finally came out. He finished this in 1993. And lo, these 2 years later, now I'm dating these tapes, but lo, these 2 years later, it finally came out. And so we're glad to see it. This is a wonderful commentary. I highly recommend it to you, and it's cheap. It's paperback, and I think it costs $11.95 or $10.95 or something quite worth the money. So you may want to have a look at this. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to draw on his reading of this chapter 19 because I think it's very enlightening what he does here. So I'm going to describe a few things, and then I'm going to actually read a passage for you because I want you to hear how this commentary reads. It reads like few other commentaries that you may have encountered. Many times commentaries are kind of atomistic, and they go verse by verse, and it's hard to kind of get the flow. This covers the ground, but it does it in such a way that it sort of pulls you along. So, again, I'm not getting a cut in royalties. He is a personal friend, but I'm not getting a cut in royalties. That's not why I recommend it. It is a very good commentary. Well, as we come into chapter 19, as Ian Provin expresses it, Ahab has offered as little serious opposition as the God he worships. Surely, in Elijah's mind, it's all over. There's been very little resistance. He's won the day. But Elijah is now to see that to win a battle is not necessarily to win a war. That realization will send him into retreat, both physical and mental, as victory becomes defeat. Retreat will in turn lead him to another mountain to confront not Baal, but the Lord himself, the God whom Elijah serves, but whose ways he only partly understands and accepts. Just if you're a little fuzzy as to what happens in chapter 19, this is the time when Elijah finds himself on a mountain where he hears that still, small voice, prior to which he sees those dramatic manifestations, and it is said, but the Lord was not in the wind, the Lord was not in the fire, the Lord was not in the earthquake, but in the still, small voice. And so that's the account we're talking about. We'll look at verses 1 and 2 of chapter 19. Now, Ahab told Jezebel everything Elijah had done and how he had killed all the prophets with the sword. So Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah to say, may the gods deal with me, be it ever so severely, if by this time tomorrow I do not make your life like that of one of them. In other words, your number is up. Thus far, Elijah's really only been dealing with Ahab and with the prophets of Baal. But Jezebel is the real power, and with a rather good track record in terms of disposing of God's prophets. We read 18:4, 18:13 already. Verse 3, Elijah was afraid, or the Hebrew actually says, now Elijah saw the way it was. And you have a text note to that effect. He saw what the deal was. The two words, afraid and to see, are very similar in Hebrew, so it's quite easy to confuse the two. I tend to prefer what's in the note there. Elijah saw how things were. He thought he had had a complete victory. Then he realized, oops, I overlooked Jezebel, and she's the general. So Elijah saw and ran for his life. When he came to Beersheba in Judah, he left his servant there while he himself went a day's journey into the desert. He came to a broom tree, sat down under it, and prayed that he might die. I have had enough, Lord, he said. Take my life. I am no better than my ancestors. Then he lay down under the tree and fell asleep. It comes as something of a surprise after Elijah's grand victory in chapter 18 that he is now fleeing. Now, of course, he knows how to hide when God tells him to hide. Back in chapter 17, verses 3 to 5, we read about God instructing him to go to the brook Cherith, where he will be provided for by the ravens and so forth. That was a time, having pronounced the drought, or predicted the drought, that he was to go into more or less hiding at God's command. He knows how to hide, but here the word of the Lord is conspicuously absent. There's nothing, there's no word of the Lord that tells him to flee at this particular juncture. I think, in fact, this was Elijah's choice at this point. The word of the Lord does not come until verse 9, and there it comes as a question. So, faced by Jezebel's persistent adherence to her gods, even against all the evidence which had been delivered on Mount Carmel, Elijah, as Proven puts it, forgets to think theologically and simply reacts for the first time to circumstances. Even Elijah can forget God, can forget the good theology that he should embrace. And he sees Jezebel, not God, standing between him and Jezebel, and so he flees. Then we come to verse 5b. Now, in 5a, Elijah has lain down under the tree and has fallen asleep. In 5b, all at once, an angel touched him and said... Now, you miss this in the English, but that word angel is earlier in verse 2 translated messenger. You know, angel, messenger, malach, same thing in Hebrew, same word. And so I think if we were reading this in Hebrew, it would be something as it kind of cause a chill to run down your spine, because you see, Jezebel was the one who sent a messenger. Suddenly, while he's sleeping, a messenger touched him. And I think our initial reaction would, oops, has she caught him? Has the messenger found him? A messenger touched him and said, get up and eat. He looked around, and there by his head was a cake of bread baked over hot coals in a jar of water. He ate and drank and then lay down again. Now, in verse 7, the messenger, the angel is now identified. The angel of Yahweh, of the Lord, came back a second time and touched him and said, get up and eat, for the journey is too much for you. He's been saying, I've had too much, I've had enough. Same phrase in Hebrew. I've had enough, Lord, take my life. Now the angel of the Lord is saying, you know, really, it is too much for you, but it's the journey that you're going to undertake that's too much for you. So, verse 8, so he got up and ate and drank. Strengthened by the food, he traveled 40 days and 40 nights until he reached Horeb, the mountain of God. There he went into a cave and spent the night. Now, there's nothing to suggest that this particular journey was at the behest of God. Now, he's been strengthened for the journey, but there's nothing to suggest that God has sent him on this journey. In fact, he seems to be like Jonah, going without divine travel permit. He seems to be going where he thinks he needs to go. He's attempting to write, as Provin puts it, attempting to write his own contract for the job of prophet. The question that arises with all these kind of allusions to the 40 days and 40 nights, kind of remind us of the 40 years in the wilderness. The question is, will he encounter God on the mountain of God? That's where he finds himself now, Mount Horeb, Mount Sinai. Yeah, Sandra. Oh, no, I don't think... I think this happened, you see. No, I'm saying... Yeah, the question is, am I suggesting that the appearance of this messenger of the Lord and the food and such was all in a dream? No, I think that is God's doing. All I'm saying is that his journey south, his journey away from Jezebel, I think is something that was motivated by his fear and not motivated by command of God. Because God will later turn him right around and send him back north. Okay? The question then that arises is, will he encounter God here? He's on the mountain of God, and that brings us to verse 9. There he went into a cave and spent the night, and the word of the Lord came to him. What are you doing here, Elijah? This again confirms that God didn't send him there. If he had sent him, he wouldn't be asking him what he's doing. He says, what are you doing here, Elijah? And Elijah replied, I have been very zealous for the Lord God Almighty. The Israelites have rejected your covenant, broken down your altars, and put your prophets to death with the sword. I'm the only one left, and now they're trying to kill me too. Notice how Jezebel has become they. Now they're trying to kill me too. Verse 11, the Lord said, go out and stand on the mountain in the presence of the Lord, for the Lord is about to pass by. Then a great and powerful wind tore the mountains apart and shattered the rocks before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. After the wind, there was an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. After the earthquake came a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire came a gentle whisper. Some translations say a thin, small voice, a skinny voice, a barely audible voice. After the fire came a gentle whisper. When Elijah heard it, he pulled his cloak over his face and went out and stood at the mouth of the cave. Now, in answering the question that God poses to him, what are you doing here, Elijah? We see selective memory with a vengeance. Again, Provin's phrase. Selective memory with a vengeance. It's not now just Jezebel. It's they who are trying to kill me. Elijah needs to remember the past and to regain his perspective. He has done better than his ancestors, in fact. That business on Mount Carmel was quite dramatic. It was a great victory. But he's certainly not the only one left. We can look at verse 10. If you were to look back at verse 10, I think it is in chapter 18. Am I in the right place? No, I'm sorry. I'll overlook that because I think I may have a false reference there. But Provin describes it this way. He says, somewhere between exaggerated self-loathing and exaggerated self-importance, both themselves partly the product of selective memory, there is a quiet place which Elijah must rest content with who he is and what he has done. And the key is to remember his past with the Lord. Now, here's where I want to pick up and just read you a section that begins on page 145 at the very bottom so that you hear the way Provin goes on to work through this particular passage. The key is to remember his past with the Lord. And so the Lord has fed him and now brought him to Horeb for another mountaintop experience. He needs to see once again the God of wind, earthquake, fire, and to remember Carmel. But that is not all there is to it, for Horeb, also known as Sinai, is not just any mountain. It is the mountain of God, the place where Israel herself, having been sustained in the wilderness, met with the Lord and discovered in some detail what sort of God she served. This is significant. It appears that the Lord is intent here not only on reminding Elijah of his recent history, but also on teaching him something new. The emphasis at Carmel had been on God's spectacular ways, and particularly on his use of fire. The emphasis in verses 11 to 12, however, is upon God's quiet ways. He's not to be found in the spectacular elements of the storm outside the cave, wind, earthquake, fire. He reveals himself on this occasion in a gentle whisper. Elijah needs to remember the past, but he also needs to realize that there is more to the Lord than fire. It's not immediately clear to us why it is important for Elijah to realize this, and there's no evidence that Elijah himself understands. Indeed, even the attempt to jog his memory appears to fail. For when he is asked a second time the question of verse 9, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" He's asked it again in verse 13. His answer is exactly the same as before. The entire point of the demonstration appears, like the Lord himself, to have passed him by. Privileged like Moses to see, he remains steadfastly like Jonah, slow to understand. There is indeed just a suggestion that he does not particularly wish to understand. He has always claimed to stand before the Lord, and he gives the Hebrew phrase there, which is translated in the NIV, "whom I serve." Quite a different sense there. He has always claimed to stand before the Lord, yet now, in spite of the command of verse 11, "go out and stand in the presence of the Lord," he apparently stays in the cave until the storm is over. When he does go out, it is with his cloak over his face. He seems as committed to not seeing as Jezebel was in 19:1-2. And so his perspective is still the one that she has inspired in him. "All is lost, and I am feeling very sorry for myself." It is the Lord's response on the second occasion that suggests what the point of the gentle whisper really was. He gives Elijah new instructions, and this is what comes up later in the chapter, which we haven't read. He gives Elijah new instructions: anoint Hazael, Jehu, Elisha. A new order is to succeed the old, and is to this order, and it is this order that will bring about the final victory over Baal worship. Victory will come, in other words, as a result of political process, not through obviously spectacular demonstrations of divine power. It will arrive not as a result of Elijah's efforts, but through the efforts of others. Elijah's role in the overall strategy is now clear. It is partly to fight, and he has done that well. But it is also partly, and now more importantly, to prepare the way for others. The Carmel event is only one event in a series that will stretch beyond his lifetime. God has other ways of working, some of which make Elijah's God seem almost as non-existent as Baal, a still small voice being only marginally noisier than no voice at all. The Lord also has servants other than Elijah, not least the 7,000 in Israel who have not bowed down to Baal or kissed him in veneration. If the spectacular has not produced final victory, that is no reason for despair. For the overall strategy was always more long-term and more subtly conceived than Elijah imagined. From the beginning, it had involved the gentle but devastating whisper as well as the all-consuming fire, the quiet ways of God's normal providence as well as the noisier ways of miraculous intervention. Elijah must be content with being part of the plan and not the plan itself. Where he has run south in despair to the desert of Beersheba, he must now go north in obedience to the desert of Damascus. And I could go on and on. This, I really like this because it is the kind of commentary that does, I hope, sort of pull you along, particularly if you know the story and you've puzzled, what does this mean? You know, what is the point of this still small voice? How does this function in the life of Elijah? Why has he fled south? And so forth and so on. I think this really makes a great deal of sense. And the way it's written is in a way that really communicates, I think, to us. Elijah must be content with being part of the plan and not the plan itself. And as we read things like that, I think we begin to get a picture of how applicable these kinds of narratives are to us. You know, our job is partly to fight, and partly to prepare the way for others. We need to realize that we are part of God's plan, but we're not the plan itself. We need to be careful of selective memory with a vengeance. You know, I'm the only one left. Or sometimes we say, the only ones left are you and me, and I'm not too sure about you. We tend to get into that same kind of funk, if you can use that in a biblical context, that Elijah seemed to be in. He needed to learn something about himself. He needed also to learn something about his Lord. Now, I would love to go on, but I don't think I will, because it kind of gets boring, even reading something this good, to just read it in class. Now, are there comments or questions on this episode? Yes. I think when God first appeared to Moses on Sinai, it was with these dramatic manifestations. And it's clear, you know, when the text says God was not in the fire, the earthquake, the wind, the earthquake, the fire, it's clear that he sent them. He's in charge of them. He's not solely in those. He's not primarily in this instance in those. And so he is, in a way, bringing back a recollection of that dramatic occurrence on that mountain, just as Elijah has experienced a dramatic event on another mountain, on Mount Carmel. But God needs to show Elijah it's not always going to be dramatic. Sometimes it's going to be still, small, almost imperceptible. But God is still at work. Now, you're a part of the plan, but you're not the plan itself. God makes use of other servants. And his task is to go off and anoint these others. Now, the curious thing is, Elijah still seems to be rather obtuse. And as Provin points out, we don't hear of him anointing any of these guys. He does go and throw his mantle over Elisha, but we never hear of his anointing. And we never hear of the anointing of Hazael, and it will be Elisha who will work out the anointing of Jehu. All of those things raise questions in our minds if we think of Elijah as a kind of an automaton who just does what God tells him. But he was a person. And we see God giving him instructions here, which he seemed either to misperceive or just not get on with, and never accomplished, at least in terms of the record we have. That fell to others. Yes? A punishment, or the question is whether there is any hint of things being taken away from Elijah and given to Elisha. I don't think so. I don't think anything in particular comes to mind. I think we see here again God simply dealing graciously with Elijah, trying to bring him along, trying to open his eyes, and Elijah only partially willing to see that. You know, this business about coming out of the cave with his cloak over his face. It wasn't because of the dramatic manifestations. Those were now past. It was more or less, you know, kind of like, I don't really fully want to see what may be there for me to see now. Other comments, questions? Yes? Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, again, if I can compress the comment into a shorter length, I think essentially what you're saying is you do see in Elijah perhaps a focus on I. And the recurrence of that pronoun and what I have accomplished. And that can, I think, issue in a wrongful sense of what, in fact, he shoulders. What is his responsibility? He sees himself as I against Jezebel. And that causes him to flee. Perhaps if he were less conscious, if he were to diminish a bit and allow God to grow greater in his eyesight, that would help him in dealing with someone like Jezebel. I know I didn't quite capture what you were trying to say there, but yeah. The question is there significance to the fact that Elijah simply pops up from nowhere and is described as a Tishbite? I would be the last one ever to say that any detail in the text is insignificant. I don't know what the significance of that might be, but it might be worth looking at. Most things that we read in Scripture are in some way significant. Now, we don't want to read in all kinds of hidden meanings that are not legitimated by the rest of the text, but it's certainly worth looking into. I don't know of anything in specifically significant about it. Yes? Yeah. Right. Yeah, the comment is, in a way, it struck this commenter that perhaps Elijah was doing the right thing running to the mountain of the Lord, because we tend to run to God in moments of distress. Or is he simply trying to escape a difficult situation. Again, I think, you know, those are the kinds of ambiguities with which we can play and wonder about. I think the fact that God asks him, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" and Elijah's response does seem, as Ian Provin expressed it, that he has begun to fall into an exaggerated sense of self-importance, and perhaps an exaggerated sense of his isolation. He thinks he's the only one left. And so God is saying to him, you know, why are you here? There's work for you to do there. You didn't need to come all this way. You didn't need to flee Jezebel. All right, next time what we're going to do, we didn't get to it tonight, but that's fine. We'll get to it next time. We will deal with Ezra Nehemiah, so please bring outlines of that. We'll also talk about the synoptic histories of the Old Testament. And by that I mean that big corpus, Samuel, Kings, and also Chronicles. Now, I'm not asking you to even read Chronicles. I'm not asking you to write an outline of Chronicles or anything. But I do want to talk about what we can learn from these. And so, in the back of your outline that I handed out, perhaps as a little exercise that may ring a bell if you're studious and clever, or it may not if you work rather quickly, I would like you to begin on page 37, where it says section 15, the promise, the divine promise to David. This is from James Newsom's Synoptic Harmony of Samuel, Kings, and Chronicles. You see the little reduced title page in the lower left-hand corner, so you can see where that comes from, Baker Publication. If you will look, if you will read in parallel these two accounts of the divine promise to David, one in 2 Samuel 7, beginning in verse 1 and running through verse 17. The other beginning in 1 Chronicles 17, verse 1, and running through verse 15. So it'll be on page 39, right about in the middle, that you should stop. If you would just read these two in parallel and just kind of make a mental note or even jot down a written note, the kinds of significant differences you discover working through this. It is a very fun and intriguing exercise to take this book or a book like it and simply read the two histories side by side, because you learn so much about what the apparent modus operandi, the ways of working of the biblical historians were by doing this. And if we don't do this kind of thing, then sometimes we work in abstract ways, thinking our own thoughts about what they must have done rather than seeing what they actually did. So if you would just read that section, 2 Kings 7, 1 to 17, 1 Chronicles 17, 1 to 15, side by side, always comparing the two, and just see what kinds of differences you come up with. If you would do that before next time, then that will enlighten our discussion as we get into this. So that next time, and Ezra, Nehemiah. I will also try to have some words to say about the final next time.